Brother John, please.
Well, it's been a year now since we looked at Samuel. At that time, we looked at before he was old. And now we'd like to look at him when he was old. It is the pivotal point in his life and a pivotal point in the time of Israel and in the purpose of God. And there's some pertinent items from that first series of talks I want to spend a moment on that we keep it familiar in our minds. Firstly, that about Samuel's personal statistics, that is his name, lineage, and hometown of Ramah. And secondly, the spiritual status of Israel, their attitude toward the Lord, the tabernacle, and the Ark of the Covenant. When we looked at his name, we found that many people say that it's God hears or the Lord hears. But that is not what you get out of the construction of the Hebrew. We found that it is God his name, or what the word really means there, God his strength. And that comes out in Hannah's prayer when she turns the little boy Samuel over to the Lord. For in her prayer, which is spoken again by Mary at the time that Gabriel had told her that she would give birth to Jesus, she ends the prayer with, "The Lord shall judge the ends of the earth, and he shall give strength unto his king and exalt the horn of his Messiah," both of which have the same idea of this part of his name. Secondly, his hometown. We had looked at his hometown, and we realized that there are many places that are called Ramah, because Ramah simply means a hill, and there are a lot of hills in Israel. And there are quite a few places named in the Bible as Ramah. But we have a specific one here, for Samuel's father is introduced to us this way. And it's literally a certain man of the Ramathites, Zuphs of Mount Ephraim, an Ephrathite. He's not an Ephraimite, but an Ephrathite from what is known as Ephrah. And Mount Ephraim means the Mount of Fruitfulness. It's a great mount that runs from Ephraim right down through Judah. And in the way of Ephrath is to travel Mount Ephraim. And Ramah is in Ephrath in the way from Bethel to Bethlehem. Ramah is in the land of the Zophites in Benjamin in Mount Ephraim. And the Zophites living in Ramah, they're called Ramathites as well as Ephrathites, because Ephraimites are of the tribe of Ephraim. Ephrathites live in Ephrah, and he is a Levite. Samuel is an Ephrathite, a Ramathite, a Zophite, a Korathite, a Kohathite, and a Levite by his genealogical heritage. So where is Ramah then? The Ramah is this one here in Benjamin. It's in an area called Mount Ephraim. And we'll find that when you look where Deborah judged from. She judged between these two places in Mount Ephraim. That's Benjamin's territory. So we see that the Ramah involved here is most likely this Ramah here. And there will be other reasons why we will come to that conclusion as we carry on. What about the spirituality of Israel? It waned up and down during the entire period of the judges. And during Samuel's life as a judge, it was no different. For sure, they recognized Samuel to have a special relationship with the Lord, but the people appear to have been content to view Samuel as the only honest man in Israel they could mutually trust, just as the people were content to respect Moses as the honest one among their midst and went to him to judge all their matters. They really were not following the Lord. And of course, we know that the time of Joshua, when his death occurred, we began a period known as no king in the land. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And now we're going to see a king in the land. So that phraseology would apply to that entire period from the time that Joshua dies to the time which I would suggest to you is actually his Samuel's last judgment, when he is raised and Saul hears the pronouncement of his death that day. So the spirituality was centered in their own self-interest. They worshiped the Lord basically with lip service. And the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant are very interesting, because we recall that when Samuel was young, the Ark was taken by the Philistines and came back to Kirjath-Jearim here. We're told that the tabernacle was at Shiloh, it was here at Bethel, it was here at Gibeon, it was at Nob. Those are the locations that we have, which we read of in this time frame. And we know that Samuel has created an altar in his hometown of Ramah. So things are actually worse under Samuel's period of judgeship. For in his day, the Holy of Holies is an empty space. In his days, the Ark of the Covenant has lost its mystique to the people of power and of the seat and dwelling place of their God, and was never returned to the tabernacle. And how could they return it? They would have no desire to, because they saw it as the throne of a powerless God. They lost to the Philistines. And having lost that and not taking it back, the priesthood is ineffectual. Why? They cannot perform their duty on the Day of Atonement. There's nothing in there. They cannot go in and perform their duty to obtain forgiveness of sins. So the tabernacle has become a hollow symbol of worship, because it has no ark. And the priests, they're basically just window dressing on the tabernacle. And so we have Samuel as the only individual that the people come to, and he has an altar in his hometown. So that's the background to when Samuel was old. So Samuel is old. Just what does it mean to be old? Those who are older than I am know very well what it means, and I'm finding that out myself now. Well, the Hebrew word that appears here appears in a number of other places, and we have them listed there. Abraham was no longer able to sire children when he was 99. He's called old. Isaac's eyesight was greatly diminished. He was about 91 years old. Eli's eyes were dim like Isaac's eyes, and he was 98. David's bodily functions no longer generated heat within him, and he was 70 years old. And Jehoiada the priest, he dies being an old man at 130 years of age. And Solomon describes himself as an old man when he writes Ecclesiastes, as he's approaching 60 years of age. So when Samuel was old, it is very probable that he's something like 70 to 90 years of age. He can't be too much less. And we're told also that when he was old, he appointed his sons to be judges. And it would take time for for them in their judgeship to develop the reputation they developed, because he wouldn't have named them if he thought that's the way they would have behaved. And we know that when people get power of any sort, power can very quickly corrupt them. And if we think 70 to 90 years of age is a bit high, we must remember that Caleb was 85 years old when he said, "I'm as strong as when I was 40. And he took Hebron in battle. So we do have plausible reason to say, speak of Samuel as old at about this age. Now, having said that, we also face the task of how long did Samuel live as an old man? And this slide, which we don't want to go through in any detail, it merely lists the various chapters from chapter 8 on to the end of the book of 1 Samuel. And what we have, and I think I have forgotten to turn this on. Is it on? It's on. The yellow marks are where Samuel is mentioned in the record. And you'll notice where Samuel dies. It's in the middle of Saul's hunting for David to destroy him. And those things you can pretty well point out as being in the very end of Saul's reign. It's got to be in the last 10 years because David's only 30 when he ascends to the throne. He has had to have quite a number of years as a warrior to build up his reputation with Saul before he gets into the situation where Saul wants to destroy him. So it's logical that it might be in the last 5 years of Saul's life that Samuel dies. Perhaps 2 or 3 years before he dies, but somewhere in that era. And he would have been something of approaching 110 to 130 years of age. And that age for dying, we might say, well, that might be a bit too much. But then again, Joseph, who preceded him by a few hundred years, he lived to be 110, and Jehoiada the priest was 130 when he died several hundred years later. So we have reasonable grounds to say that this is a reasonable assumption. Now, we're told that Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. And that would mean all the days from when he was young, also when he was old. And we're told that, and it must mean that, he never ceased to be a judge during his entire lifetime, even during the time of Saul as king. When we read the activities of Samuel with Saul during the course of Saul's kingship, we are struck by Samuel still being very active in the role of a judge during that time, at least for more than 20 years of it, at least almost up to 30. So Saul was king, but Samuel was still the judge, and we can recognize that if we consider the record of these two men during that time. The qualities that Saul showed as king in his first year changed in the second year, and after that, it was nothing but downhill for Saul for the remaining 38 years. And remarkably, the last act of Samuel as a judge is on the beginning of the very last day of Saul's life, when the Lord brings Samuel up from the dead to judge Saul, having come to the witch of Endor. And we should not discount that act of Samuel as part of his judgeship. It's the last time he ever judged Israel. Thus, we can say Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, even to the last day
of Saul's reign. Now we have here a slide, and we have, this should be 300 years, I have a mistake there. Excuse me, it is right. 30 years after entering the land and 400 years after entering the land is Judges, chapters 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, and 1 Samuel. This is the period where it speaks of, in those days, there was no king in the land. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. The people didn't desire a king. But we're told in Judges 18, that idol worship was established. It was established up in Dan with its own priesthood, and that continued for 700 years, where we're told that it continued until they were taken away in captivity, which was the Assyrian conquest of Israel. And in Judges, chapters 19, 20, and 21, we have the story of the tribe of Benjamin defending the debauchery of the men of Gibeah. And Israel utterly destroys Benjamin as a tribe, leaving 600 men to survive. And over here we have the other things that were happening some 400 years later. The people desired a king, just to reverse. 1 Samuel 8, all Israel wants a king, just like the other nations, to judge them and to lead Israel into battle against nations. God gives them their desire. He gives them the biggest, most powerfully built man in Israel, a man of the tribe of Benjamin from Gibeah. And that man, in his second year, their king, the man of Gibeah, refuses to obey the Lord's prophet, making himself a priest and king. He's doing the sacrificing now to the Lord. And he continues in this manner of rebelling to the last day of his life. We also are told in 1 Samuel 22 that this king, this man of Gibeah, he slaughters the priests of the Lord who attend the tabernacle of the Lord, for he slew them at Nob. We see that there is a correlation between what happened in the book of Judges and now in the life of Samuel, as we start to have a king entering the land, all under the reversal of this title here. So we have Samuel, he's an old man. We have his sons, who are unsuitable successors. We have the elders of Israel, who find themselves in a grave dilemma. For 1 Samuel chapter 12 and 12 tells us that the Ammonites were coming to attack Israel. And for that reason, they wanted a king instead of Samuel to act as their deliverer. Not only were they going to face an attack from the Ammonites, which would be on the east side of Jordan, they were under vassalage to the Philistines. We're told in 1 Samuel 13, verses 19 to 22, that the Philistines had taken all the swords and spears out of Israel. They would not let them have them. And they were the overlords of Israel. On the west side of Jordan, their primary interest was the west side, but they had them on both the west side and those that were in Gilead on the east side. And of course, the most vulnerable group are those on the east side to an attack from the Ammonites, who are right to the east of them as their neighbors. Also, the elders at this time are the next generation. They're the generation that did not see Samuel with the bleating lamb, sacrificing it, calling upon the Lord, and thunder roared out, and the Philistines were defeated. These people hadn't seen it. Their faith wasn't in God, and their faith wasn't necessarily in Samuel's God, because Samuel now, in their eyes, was too old to lead them. Tabernacle of the Ark, they're both, well, they're there, but they are of no interest to the people. All the people could really agree upon was that they had one man in all of Israel that they all trusted to make a decision for them that they would all accept. And so they've got to go to Samuel with their request for a king. And so the emphasis is, they want a king like all the nations. And God told Samuel, they've rejected me as king. Not you, they've rejected me. But they have forsaken me. The same way they've forsaken you, they've served other gods. They're worshiping idols. That's God's assessment of Israel coming to Samuel, asking for a king. He's saying, they're idol worshipers. And when Samuel gives out the list of what a king will do to them, they still go and say, no, give us a king that we may also be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us, and fight for us. Now they're admitting to that. That's why they want him. So Israel forsook the Lord and also forsook Samuel in the sense that they would not worship the Lord, nor would they go and be like Samuel, who served God all his life. And we're going to see those phrases come back at us. This is the list of what they were given. We had it read this evening. There's a military draft. No one's exempt. Families' lands, confiscated. I like that, they're mine. That's the end of the subject. This family, that family, that family, that family, you're my servant. You're going to do this, you're going to do that. I'm sorry, but you no longer have a life of your own. Going to impress their daughters to be servants, to take care of supplying all the food that's necessary for his great retinue of people, his armies, his household servants, everything else. He's going to confiscate the remaining best of the people's lands, and he's going to give it to his own retinue, his army, generals, etc., and his principal servants. He's going to impose taxation of the best of everyone's work to finance the king's desires. He's going to force the people to satisfy the king's ego, building monument cities and buildings for the king, taking away all the freedom from the people, making them bond slaves to the king. And God told them, you tell them, they'll bitterly complain about this, and I won't listen to them. And if they thought they were having problems with the Philistines being their overlords, a king, a bad king, is far worse. And it's at this point that Saul enters the picture. And we're told that Saul's son Jonathan is an able warrior in the second year of Saul's reign. So he was an able warrior. He's a man well into his 20s, which is one of the reasons why we would have Saul somewhere around 50 years of age, give or take, at the time that he is anointed king. So Saul would have been born at a time pretty close to when Samuel had offered that bleating lamb and the Philistines were defeated when he was a young man. And Saul would grow up as a child, probably heard about that, and probably heard about this man, Samuel, who's in a town called Ramah, some 3 kilometers away, because he's in Gibeah. And it appears, though, when we read 1 Samuel chapter 8, that Saul doesn't have a clue who Samuel is. His servant knows about him. He knows that he's in this town of Ramah. And the record almost indicates that Saul hasn't got a clue. And I think, though, that that's stretching it a bit. I think it's more that he had knowledge of him, but he had no interest in him and no interest in the God that he worshiped. And Samuel, when he first meets Saul, he's confronted with a man he's never seen before. Not an Israelite like this. Head and shoulders taller than anything he's ever seen in all his years. Saul must have been a very imposing figure. And for people who lived in that era, they were well developed physically, for they did hard labor. There were very few desk-type jobs in those days. So Saul, admirably, immediately fits the requirements of a king, a mighty, strong warrior. But Samuel was told something else by the Lord concerning Saul, that he was of the tribe of Benjamin. And Samuel would have been well aware of Jacob's blessing upon Judah in Genesis 49, that the scepter would not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. And that's speaking of a king. And he would understand that the Lord was going one day to provide a king, but out of Judah. And undoubtedly, it went through his mind, Saul is not that, so he must be a king that the people wanted, who's going to be just like the kings of the other nations. And regardless of his thoughts or his misgiving, Samuel obeys the Lord and immediately honors Saul. He gives Saul his own seat at the head of the table. He gives Saul the portion of the sacrifice that Samuel would have received. He receives Saul to his house, spoke to him that night, and the next day he anointed Saul captain of the Lord's inheritance. Now there are two things which occur that are of interest to us in our class. The first is found in 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 19. On meeting Saul, Samuel immediately tells Saul, "I will tell thee all that is in thine heart." And he adds to that at verse 20, "And on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on thee and on all thy father's house?" The lost asses were Saul's immediate concern. But what Samuel is saying implies Saul was preoccupied with some other desire in his heart, a desire to be the king Israel was now asking Samuel to appoint. And Saul knew what he was. He knew he was physically the most powerful built man in Israel. And there was no equal, no one that even came close. But we also find that he seems to be a timid man, for he hides when he's supposed to be shown unto Israel. We also know that he's a son of Kish, a very wealthy man of the tribe of Benjamin. So he's of an important family. He has all the things going for him to be a king, except for, how do I get appointed? Now, the second thing we want to consider is Samuel's closing words when he gave him three signs from God that Saul would encounter as he would walk back to Gibeah from Ramah. And the three signs are obviously all miraculous, for they are far removed from the road between Ramah and Gibeah, and they're far removed from one another. Mount Tabor is one location, way up north. But these were to show Saul that the Lord would be with him. And that was a sign that was being shown him. But Samuel has closing words, which are a proviso on what the Lord will do for Saul. And that's at verse 8. Thou shalt go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down unto thee to offer burnt offerings and to sacrifice sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days shalt thou tarry till I come to thee and show thee what thou shalt do. The question we must ask is this: when did this happen? What was Samuel going to show Saul that he shall do? Well, what happens in the first year is this, and it's in 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 17. We're told that Samuel gathers all Israel together to go down to Mizpah, not to Gilgal. It's to the place that hundreds of years earlier, Israel had all come and gathered themselves together with one accord to destroy the men of Gibeah. And now they were going to gather at that same place to have a man of Gibeah made king over them. Rather ironic, isn't it? Then in 1 Samuel 11, verse 7, which is not many days later, we're told the reason why the people went to Samuel in the first place. The Ammonites wanted to besiege them, and now they're besieging Jabesh-Gilead on the other side of Jordan, and they have a special demand on them. No matter what happens, you surrender to us, you pay us all the tribute you want, we're going to still thrust out your right eyes in order that we can make a reproach upon Israel. And Saul is aroused by the Lord to summon all Israel to bring relief to Jabesh-Gilead. And Saul, we're told, takes a yoke of oxen. He hews them into pieces and sends them around Israel. He tells everyone, gather together. That's exactly what the Levite did several hundred years earlier with his concubine who had been abused by the men of Gibeah. Cut her up, sent her about Israel, and told them to gather. And they gathered with one mind. Ironic. It might appear that Benjamin is now perhaps going to be able to remove the stigma of his demise 300 years earlier when Israel wiped them out down to 600 men. But we're going to find that's not true. Benjamin is now going to enter into a final decline as it rules over Israel. And yes, a great victory is won against the Ammonites. And Saul makes a judgment and a request to slaughter those who didn't come down. And he acts like a true judge by pardoning them. And he gives the Lord the glory, saying, "The Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel." And immediately upon that, at verse 14, Samuel says, "Come now, let us go down to Gilgal." But there's no 7-day waiting. We still haven't gotten to that period. And so they go down to Gilgal, and he says, to renew the kingdom there. This slide summarizes the irony of Saul being made king over Israel, like the other nations had, compared to the events when there was no king in Israel and Benjamin was destroyed because of the men of Gibeah. You can compare them and just look at them one side of the table to the other, all the way down. They follow in such a perfect order. We can't really say that this is only a coincidence. Benjamin the destroyed outcast becomes Benjamin the beloved king. And we have the series of events that are almost the same. And Samuel was probably very cognizant of this parallel. I don't think he was not. There are others that are not mentioned here. If you read the story side by side, you'll see some more. And Samuel tells him, "Behold, I have hearkened unto your voice. I've made a king over you. Now," and this is in chapter 12, verse 3, "now, behold, here I am. You witness against me before the Lord and before his anointed king of anything I've done wrong. And the people witness by saying, thou hast not defrauded us, neither hast thou taken of any man's hand." And that's where the record stops. It doesn't make mention of the Lord or of his anointed king. And perhaps that's a bit of an insight into the people, perhaps not. But Samuel immediately retorts that the Lord and his anointed are witness. And then they reply, yes, they're witness. Now, as I say, we might read into that little verbal exchange that the people were not really very spiritually inclined. And having said that, Samuel then starts to tell them of what the Lord has done for them from the time that they were in Egypt and progresses to their day, telling them everything the Lord has done for Israel. And then he tells them why they wanted a king in verse 12. "When you saw Nahash, the king of Ammon, come, you said no to the Lord as your king. And you wanted a man to be king to reign over you." Tell them that right to their face. You said, "No, I don't want the Lord as my king. That's why you asked me." And then in verses 17 and 18, Samuel calls upon the Lord to witness against them with thunder and rain that day. And when the people see it, they greatly fear, they admit their sin, and they plead for Samuel to intercede on their behalf. So we can see this generation is no different from all the previous generations of Israelites, except for that first one that entered the land under Joshua. And in verses 23 and 24, Samuel tells them, Regardless of what you do, I will continue without ceasing to pray for you, and I'll teach you the good and the right way, to fear the Lord, to serve him in truth with all your heart. That's the commandment. Where in verse 20, he had commanded them, saying, you shall serve the Lord with all your heart, or he will take away the king and the kingdom. And that becomes the hallmark of all the kings that follow thereafter. Having a heart like the heart of David, the king. We still have that item to consider, the 7 days Saul has to wait for Samuel at Gilgal. We find that in 1 Samuel chapter 13 and verse 1. And we're told it is the next year. It's the second year of Saul's reign. And what it is a foretelling of the test that would come on the renewed kingdom and his king set forth by Samuel when he anointed Saul to prove whether they trusted the Lord with all their heart. And the scene is this. The Philistines are coming. In 1 Samuel 13, verses 6 and 7, we're told that they're so great in number that the people fled, hiding themselves in caves, in thickets, in rocks, in high places, in pits. Some fled across the Jordan into Gilead. All Israel has fled and deserted their king. They've deserted Benjamin. They've deserted the man of Gilead. They've left the king alone to stand up to the Philistines. And that's just the reverse of what had happened some 300 years earlier when all Israel had come against Gibeah and found themselves having to wipe out the tribe of Benjamin. And Saul's heart melts as men continue to desert him. And he can't wait any longer. 7 days, it's up, and he offers the burnt offerings. And his excuse is, in verse 12, Samuel, you didn't come in time. So I forced myself to make this offering. And though the Lord had given Saul a renewed heart when he anointed him, we're told that he was given a new heart. He was made a new man. Within a year, he was back to the old man. The people didn't trust in the Lord with all their heart, and Saul didn't trust in the Lord with all their heart. And that's the reason Samuel says to him, thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his heart to be captain over Israel. And that is the introduction getting us into David. Well, what follows here at Gilgal is quite remarkable because Saul and his remaining men go back up to Gibeah. They're going to hole up in Gibeah against the Philistines. And in 1 Samuel 14, verse 2, we're told that he's got 600 men with him. Same number of Benjamites that survived Israel's onslaught on them 300 years earlier. And they're gathered there to defend the man of Gibeah and his actions in not trusting the Lord, doing what was right in his own eyes, just as it was 300 years ago when they took the Levite's concubine. And Samuel leaves Gibeah, and we're told that what happens now is Jonathan and his armor bearer They go out alone against the Philistines. And 1 Samuel 14, verse 7 sets the comparison between Jonathan and his armor bearer and Saul and the other 600. Jonathan's armor bearer tells him, "Do all that is in thine heart. Turn thee. Behold, I am with thee according to thy heart." That was the commandment. And Jonathan trusted in the Lord with all his heart. And that is the reason he was going to go up, because the Lord can save with few just as he can with many. And we've got to compare that to Saul sitting in the middle of Gibeah surrounded by his 600 men. And verse 18. Saul now commands the priest, the descendant of Eli, to bring the Ark of the Covenant from Kirjath-Jearim to Gibeah. It's the only mention of any thought of moving that ark. And we ask, why would Saul do that as he's hearing the noise of tumult way off of battle among the Philistines? And he's counted up and he's found that there are only two men missing from his group, Jonathan and the armor bearer. Undoubtedly, he now was looking at the ark with a different eye. Samuel was gone. Maybe the ark will save him. So he brings it. He wants to bring it in his battle with the Philistines. But before anything can happen, the tumult gets greater and greater. And so he instead gives an order. "Cursed is any man that eats any food until the evening, that I may be avenged on my enemies." The Lord isn't in Saul's thoughts, other than as a convenient tool to accomplish his heart's desires, to establish the dynasty of Saul as the kings of Israel. He doesn't need it for anything other than that. And Samuel had said he would tell Saul what was in his heart when he was at Gilgal after 7 days. And there it is. It's all about Saul. Be avenged on his enemies, not the Lord's, to perpetuate the dynasty of Saul over Israel. So when Samuel is old, the people sought a king like the nations round about them. And that is exactly the king they received. And it's all bound up in the story of the men of Gibeah, the tribe of Benjamin. As we can see, all these things revolve about the stories in the book of Judges of the Levite and the concubine and the destruction of Benjamin. And they're all wrapped up in this life of Saul, whom Samuel was told to anoint king over the people. And so it comes that the Lord says to Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul?" And with that thought, we'll close this evening. We know Samuel never ceased to pray for Israel. He did not want to cease to pray for Saul, but he was finally told he had to. So we now have the beginning of kings who trust in the Lord with all their heart. And he's sent out to Bethlehem. He's told, how long wilt thou mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go to Bethlehem. Find the man Jesse. I have provided me a king from among his sons. And later he tells him, I look not upon the physical stature of the man, but upon his heart.